before it becomes weaker to expel the Palestinians. So there's dangers ahead.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thank you. And Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Al-Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'ni wa ma tatlu وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president warns against a Zionist plot to divide Sudan. Iran and Syria renew their pledge to continue cooperation. A gunman kills 8 people in Serbia in the country's second mass shooting in less than 48 hours. And a cyber attack by a hacker group disrupts several public services in the U.S. city of Dallas. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran and Syria have issued a joint statement at the end of President Ebrahim Raisi's historic visit to the Arab country that took place on Wednesday and Thursday. The two sides have pledged to continue their strategic cooperation in all fields. The Iranian and Syrian governments agreed to expand bilateral cooperation, particularly in economy and trade. They also underlined the importance of cooperation to combat terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. Iran and Syria strongly condemned the Israeli regime's aggression as a destabilizing factor in the West Asia region. They emphasized that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's acts of aggression on Syria. The statement also denounced U.S. measures for looting Syria's natural resources, calling on the international community to bring to an end those measures. The statement, meanwhile, slammed unilateral coercive measures by the U.S. and the European Union against Iran and Syria. During his trip to Syria, President Raisi met senior officials and visited religious places. He is the first Iranian president visiting the Arab country in more than a decade.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has attended an economic forum in Syria for Iranian and Syrian businessmen. He said that the two countries are determined to expand trade and economic partnerships, stressing that currently the bulk of trade exchange between Iran and Syria is unacceptable and should increase.
The will of both governments is to expand economic relations and eliminate obstacles in the way. This visit to Syria will constitute a positive turning point in developing relations with Syria, and you will see its impact on the economy of the two countries and the region.
This forum reflects Iran's and Syria's support for the private sector aimed at enhancing economic relations between the two countries. The viewpoint of presidents of of both states was that such cooperation should be based on integration for the interests of the two nations.
Syrian and Iranian businessmen thanked their countries for the newly signed economic agreements. They said the war in Syria had blocked it from attracting investors, calling for the establishment of a joint bank, currency exchange companies, and an increase of air flights between the two states. Many of their requests were already dealt with, according to Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development.
Agreements signed recently aim to facilitate investments for businessmen. Agreements included establishing a joint bank and insurance system, as well as modifying tariffs on imports and exports. Good agreements were also reached in the transport sector. We will continue building the railway linking Iran, Iraq, and Syria for passengers and later on for goods.
On Wednesday, Iran and Syria signed an agreement on a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation, as well as memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies. The Iranian president's visit to Syria has initiated a new phase of economic cooperation between the two countries. Both states are determined to upgrade mutual trade ties to reach the level of their strategic political relations. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Iranian manufacturers have a broken Western monopoly in producing turbo expanders, a centrifugal turbine that is widely used in oil and gas industry. The Shahzand Petrochemical Company, located near the central city of Arak, has produced a turbo expander. The company developed the system in cooperation with a knowledge-based Iranian firm. The achievement helps Iran save millions of dollars previously spent to import the system, which so far was produced only by three Western countries. Turbo expanders are very widely used as sources of refrigeration in industrial processes such as the extraction of ethane and natural gas liquids. And the Iranian nation is mourning the martyrdom of Hamidreza Aldaghi, a man who lost his life while defending two members of the community against hooligans. His death has once again unified the Iranian nation and showed that Iran's zeal for protecting the oppressed is within every particle of their soul. Here's a report.
Not only in the stories, some are among us and remind us of the fact that chivalry is not dead yet. Hamidreza Aldaghi is one of them. The Iranian nation is mourning his death after he was brutally stabbed in the back and chest while defending two girls against a number of knife-wielding thugs in one of the streets of the northeastern city of Sabzavar. He later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. Thousands of people from different walks of life took part in his funeral, hailing him as the martyr of courage and a brave national hero. His wife says he acted based on his zeal for defending the oppressed.
This could have happened anywhere else. My husband defended an oppressed person and fought until the last breath. This is the ultimate bravery.
To get a better understanding of the social aspect of this incident, I talked to a sociologist who noted that Martyr Aldaghi's brave act should be venerated by the people.
Here you see a citizen who acts based on his social responsibility as he observes a crime being committed. He has social commitment. This is very valuable, especially at a time when the global trend is individualism and people are after their own interests. Now a member of the society has stood up to defend another person and identifies with her. We must recognize this brave act and introduce this person as a role model to the society.
While a CCTV video showing the moment of Aldaghi's stabbing has gone viral, some anti-Iran media have tried to use it to attack the Islamic Republic's values. To get a better understanding of this, I asked Mr. Asghari about their intention.
Another aspect of this incident is that in social media you observe a rather different approach toward this brave act. Some media outlets follow frameworks that do not support Iran's national interests. The martyrdom of Hamidreza Aldaghi has once again unified Iranian society. However, we see anti-Iran media try to use every incident to polarize the society, cause enmity among people, and increase anger in the society.
Acts of sheer courage by the Iranian nation that are based on moral and social responsibility have foiled anti-Iran media campaigns.
Hamid Reza Aldaghi's martyrdom is a case in point that proves Iranians are always ready to give their lives to safeguard their values. Mati Abbasian, Tehran.
A second mass shooting hit Serbia in less than 48 hours, leaving at least 8 people dead. The shooting took place in a town south of the capital, Belgrade. 13 people were wounded as well. Local media say Serbian police have arrested the suspected gunman. Still, no official confirmation. Interior Minister has called a shooting a terrorist attack. President Aleksandar Vučić also expressed grief following the incident and called for stricter gun control measures. The shooting happened as Serbians were still shocked by another incident that took place on Wednesday. That shooting left 9 students dead after a 13-year-old boy opened fire at a school in Belgrade. He turned himself in. And thousands of employees from a major Italian telecoms operator have staged a day of strike against unbundling of the company. Max Civilli reports.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civilli, Rome.
A cyber attack by a hacker group has disrupted several public services in the U.S. city of Dallas, closing courts and taking down emergency services websites. According to local officials, Dallas's courts were closed on Wednesday and they will remain closed on Thursday. They added that the attack was carried out using a ransom, which hackers use to immobilize networks until an extortion payment is made. During recent years, the ransomware cyber attacks have had a devastating impact on U.S. companies, organizations, and local authorities. In one of the worst cases, the city of Atlanta was held hostage by hackers for several days in 2018. The city of Baltimore was also hit by online extortionists the following year. The attacks cost U.S. taxpayers millions of dollars. Palestinian activist and detainee Sheikh Qadr Adnan had been martyred in an Israeli prison after nearly 3 months of hunger strike over his illegal imprisonment. The regime even refused his family visitation rights up to his death. Palestinians view this martyrdom as a renewed call for action against Israeli colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
A well-known resistance actor within the Palestinian prisoners' movement, Qadr Adnan, has passed away on the 86th day of his hunger strike inside an Israeli prison following 2 decades of arrests. Qadr spent nearly a fifth of his life behind bars, arrested 12 times by Israeli forces and subjected to over 8 years of captivity. He used hunger strikes to take power back and mobilize the world outside his prison cell in support of the Palestinian prisoners' struggle. Sustained arbitrary arrests and medical neglect led to Qadr's death. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council thus viewed Qadr's killing as premeditated murder by the Israeli regime. Israeli prison services were holding Qadr in solitary confinement and refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. He survived by his wife and 9 children. In his lifetime, Qadr Adnan carried out 6 hunger strikes. His first protest in 2004 lasted 25 days and popularized hunger strikes as an accessible means of resistance within the regime's military prison system. His second hunger strike in 2012, that lasted 66 days, was joined by hundreds of prisoners and triggered an international movement for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. In 2015, he went on his third hunger strike for 56 days against another administrative detention. In 2017, Qadr was again arrested and went on a 58-day hunger strike. His fifth 25-day-long strike was directed at his penultimate arrest in 2021. During his most recent arrest in February, Israeli forces raided his home and terrorized his family. Qadr was no stranger to civil disobedience, therefore responded by immediately going on an open hunger strike. Israeli prison services retaliated with isolation orders, renewed every 2 weeks without review. He was held under deplorable conditions and was subjected to regular abuses. When Qadr fell seriously ill in April, ISP refused to transfer him to a hospital. Qadr was found unconscious in isolation in Ramallah Prison Clinic on May 2nd. Using deliberate medical neglect, indefinite isolation, and detention extensions, the regime foresaw and facilitated Qadr's death. He was killed behind the bars, a fate shared by over 233 Palestinian political prisoners. The international community's failure to intervene amplifies past evidence that international law is just a tool for the colonizer regime of Israel, not Palestinians. It shows that the international community aids and abets the Israeli regime's crimes by its deafening silence that today rings loud after the death of Qadr Adnan.
Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Qadr Adnan's death in an Israeli jail has sparked anger in Palestinian territories. Palestinian factions hold the Israeli regime responsible for his death, saying that Tel Aviv will pay dearly for his crime. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The pro-Israel lobby groups in the West have over the years made desperate attempts to silence and tame people, university professors, as well as independent global news networks over their coverage of Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV noted, Abir An-Najjar, who teaches media criticism, accountability and critical media literacies at the American University of Sharjah, told the Press TV website in an interview recently that these groups have sought to airbrush the colonial and apartheid policies practiced by the Israeli regime in the occupied territories. Earlier this week, U.S.-based leading pro-Israel lobby groups, the Center for Countering Digital Hate, CCDH, and the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, released a new report accusing Iran's Press TV of spreading dangerous anti-Semitism through social media platforms. The exhaustive report focused mainly on the leading Iranian international news network's weekly show, Palestine Declassified, which is co-hosted by former UK Labour Party MP Chris Williamson and former Bristol University professor David Miller. It said the critically acclaimed show spreads hateful narratives and lies about Jewish people as a whole, and that it constitutes a foreign state hate operation. Palestine Declassified, known for meticulous research and analysis, has gained tremendous popularity for highlighting the Zionist regime's unchecked aggression in the occupied Palestinian territories and seeking to build global solidarity for the Palestinian cause. An-Najjar said, "The accusation of anti-Semitism is often used to silence critics and create self-censorship, which is illustrated by the latest CCDH-ADL report against Press TV. She noted the work of these lobby groups follow a pattern that lacks clear methodological approach to practice news criticism, as they only seek to do advocacy for the Zionist regime. Hence, many of their accusations and reporting are ideologically motivated, and they entail a frequent conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism," An-Najjar remarked. Since its inception more than 15 years ago, Press TV has been known for its free and fearless coverage of Palestine, which has often made it a target of Zionist lobby groups in West. Press TV journalists and hosts have also been at the receiving end of the smear campaign. Williamson, the 66-year-old host of Palestine Declassified show and former British lawmaker, was in February stripped of his parliamentary pass for his role with Press TV. Speaking to Press TV website at the time, Williamson said he wasn't surprised by the arbitrary decision, noting that the political class in the UK has been gripped by a kind of hypocritical hysteria. The action against Williamson was primarily due to the success of his show and the way it was influencing public opinion toward Palestine and the Zionist regime in the West, as Westerners are rarely exposed to harsh realities on the ground. An-Najjar said, "Reportage on Palestine in the mainstream Western media shows limited commitments to fundamental journalistic principles, including fairness and balance. The context of the Zionist regime military occupation seems to be absent in the coverage of events in Palestine, which indicates newsroom and editorial policies," she told Press TV website. An-Najjar said about the media studies, "The systematic absence of Palestine in Western media reports undermines the global understanding of the occupation and apartheid and promotes its framing as a religious conflict. It completely blinds international public opinion of the facts that Palestinian Christians and Muslims alike have been struggling for over 70 years to achieve self-determination and independence from the Israeli regime, she hastened to add.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Khartoum has been racked with violence for nearly 3 weeks. At least 515 people have been killed and millions trapped without food, water, or electricity. While a former Janjaweed militia, the Rapid Support Forces, led by Lieutenant General Mohammed Hamdan, known as Hamiti, battles the army for control of Sudan's capital. In order to understand the reality of what is happening now, it must be linked to the comprehensive crises that the Sudanese political system has been suffering from since the country's independence in the beginning of the second half of the 50s until now, in a three-dimensional crisis. First, there is a dimension related to the raging historical conflict between the Sudanese army on the one hand and all the components of civil society and its political parties on the other hand. Since Sudan's independence from Egypt on January 1, 1956, until the present time, there's been a bitter struggle between the two parties, embodied in a series of military coups, which in turn led to popular revolutions that overthrow it and seek in vain to establish durable civil rule. Then, there's a second dimension related to the raging conflict within the Sudanese civil society institutions among themselves. Despite the vitality and great political awareness of the Sudanese people, the Sudanese political elites have always been unable to agree among themselves on a formula for managing the state and society in a way that allows neutralizing the role of the army and building a modern civil state. Now, the third dimension is related to the nature of the Sudanese military establishment itself and its instinctive tendency to interfere in political affairs. This is due to many factors, including, first, its inability to turn into a social melting pot to consolidate the idea of citizenship among those involved in it and dissolve the differences resulting from the ethnic, religious, and sectarian diversity that characterizes the Sudanese society. And second, its entry into the game of the struggle for wealth through its growing participation in various economic activities, which helped the emergence of self-interest that pushed towards its permanent involvement in political action. Add to that President Omar al-Bashir's fatal mistake in 2013 when he decided to transform the Janjaweed forces into parallel regular forces known as the Rapid Support Forces, which today exceed 100,000 individuals, placing them under the command of a leadership that is largely independent of the leadership of the armed forces. All the while, the Rapid Support Forces currently control most of the gold mines in Sudan, making its leader one of the richest men in Sudan. Hence, this current crisis, which has turned into an armed clash between two wings belonging to the Sudanese armed forces, accurately reflects the total complexities that afflicted political life and has far-reaching dimensions and repercussions at various local, regional, and international levels. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Although the declared truce in Sudan held relatively for a period of 3 days, it did not prevent the spread of fighting and chaos throughout the country, especially in the capital Khartoum and the state of West Darfur. The scene indicates that the specter of the darker scenarios has not yet passed, despite the possibility for negotiation in light of the conflicting and changing positions of the warring parties, while maintaining the same negativity towards each other. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, political commentator and expert in Arab political affairs at the Lebanese Al-Akhbar Daily. Thank you very much, Mr. Hussein, for being with us. Now, unknown parties have taken advantage of the situation inside of Sudan, and they have supplied citizens with weapons, especially when we have the state of chaos and lawlessness in the country. Now it is being feared that the area where there are tribal majorities, that there might be a war starting there as well. Because of the continuing warring sides in Khartoum, it might spill over to the tribal area where these people now have weapons as well. But, I mean, weapons don't usually just get robbed from the sky. Someone sends them these weapons. Who is pushing for a full-blown civil war inside of Sudan?
To get an idea of how the war will proceed in Sudan, we must first answer the question, how did the war in Sudan begin? The war there did not start by accident. It is a fabricated war that has been underway for a long time, for many years now, especially when the military was pushed to the forefront of the political process after the fall of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. With the intervention of external powers that wanted Sudan to slip into this kind of conflict or to be thrown into the arms of Israel. It was clear, for example, the UAE intervention in Sudan. The UAE is the one who arranged the relations between the generals of the Sudanese army, specifically between the two current fighting teams. The army commander Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the commander of the rapid intervention militia Mohammed Dagolo Hamiti on the one hand and the Israelis on the other. For example, Hamiti met in 2020 with Mossad chief Yossi Cohen in Abu Dhabi, even before Abu Dhabi itself signed the Abraham normalization agreement with the occupation entity. Likewise, the Emiratis themselves had mediated a meeting between al-Burhan and Benjamin Netanyahu. So preparations were being made to take Sudan in a direction other than its natural position years ago. Today, we are seeing the result of that. Personally, I deem what is happening in Sudan as a reaction to what is happening on the other side of the Red Sea. And by that, I mean the political changes taking place in Yemen, for example, as a result of the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement. Therefore, I believe that efforts for solutions in the Arabian Peninsula are being responded to in Sudan under the leadership of the UAE. This is because the UAE finds itself outside these rapprochements because its bets are different. Its bets are intensely on the role of Israel and the role of the United States in the region.
It was interesting, Mr. Hussein, to listen to what the Sudanese army had to say after this clash that started almost 3 weeks ago. The army indicated that its forces has taken most of the control in the capital city, and they're speaking of a certain complicated situation in neighborhoods of the capital where the rapid forces of Hamiti have been deployed. But with the decline of the frequency of the clashes that we witnessed 2 weeks ago, it seems that there is some sort of an opportunity for a peaceful solution, a peaceful negotiation. But is this opportunity a regional one or an internal one? Is it just Sudanese, or are there other parties, other foreign states working towards it?
لا انا انا اعتقد ان يعني ان الحرب
I think the war has not stopped yet. It is natural to see at the beginnings of wars when diplomatic efforts are at their height, although most of them are false efforts. Since these efforts are coming from the same parties that prompted the start of the fighting, such as the United States, Israel, and the UAE. However, it is normal at the beginning of any war that there exist intensive efforts to find a solution. Consequently, we will witness some decline in the clashes here and there. But how about any of the warring parties comes out to tell us why this war is happening? What does each side of this war want? Is one of these parties close to achieving its political goals? Is this war a problem in a lane between two men to end so quickly? And if the conflicts have already ended, shouldn't those who fought be held accountable for the disastrous results of this fighting? I mean, in a few days, hundreds of people were killed for no fault of their own. Does the blood spilled by these victims go to waste? So far, there is no talk of politics. So what is the point of this war? We only see belligerence in which one person asks the other to surrender and vice versa.
But we are actually seeing Egyptian efforts in here which are being considered effective in the current crisis inside of Sudan, in addition to the presence of Egypt at the heart of this, because at the first day when it started, we had Egyptian generals in the hands of the Hamiti militia in Merwe in northern Sudan. So Cairo began to take steps that are received internationally in a positive way, with recognition, by accepting refugees, by coordinating with mediators of the crisis, despite the fact that the mediators are, funnily enough, Israel and the UAE, as you mentioned. But will that be enough to savor Egypt from a spillover, especially that might affect its relationship with Ethiopia as well? Are we going to see a huge spillover in Africa?
Yes, it is possible to see a spillover or a transmission of the crisis to other countries. Unfortunately, I believe that Egypt, which is most affected by what is happening in Sudan, is the least effective in finding a solution to the crisis. In other words, the Egyptian efforts are near useless since Egypt is a weak country to some extent. Because its tools and diplomatic endeavors are weak, because it does not have many cards to employ in the diplomatic endeavors, you know that what plays a fundamental role in this crisis is money and weapons, as you mentioned in the first question. Money is driving this war. How do people fight without money and without weapons? And how do they fight? With what tools? Egypt does not have influence in this field, and therefore I do not think that the Egyptian efforts will lead to anything. On the other hand, Egypt is the most affected country by this war. Egypt, as you said, will be sought by the displaced in the beginning, being the main Arab country neighboring Sudan, and the fact that there is a good history between Egypt and Sudan. However, Egypt will inevitably be negatively affected, especially since other countries like Ethiopia are trying to exploit what is happening in Sudan for their benefit. We know that the Nile originates from Ethiopia, passes through Sudan and goes to Egypt, and it is the main lifeline for the Egyptians. What if he, who dominates Sudan, decides to join the Ethiopian team to play against Egypt's interests in the matter of the Nile?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems from what you're saying that we are going to see more upcoming clashes and escalations inside of Sudan. We dearly want that not to happen. We wish the best for the Sudanese people. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, political commentator and expert in Arab political affairs at the Daily Lebanese Al-Akhbar, for joining us to talk about this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the suicide rates that are skyrocketing inside the Israeli occupation army members.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, top general of the Israeli occupation army has expressed concern over the soaring number of suicides among Israeli soldiers, calling on the authorities to deal with the challenge. Now, a study found that many suicides in the Israeli army were not only diagnosed with a psychological disorder, but that most of the soldiers who committed suicide suffered from anxiety for a long time about the future and lived in a state of constant frustration, extreme confusion, and a state of unending war and continuous fighting. More details in this following report.
The Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, Kan 11, announced last week that three soldiers in the Israeli occupation army committed suicide during the last month, including two who committed suicide this past week. Kan 11 stated that a female soldier committed suicide on Thursday, while a male soldier committed suicide at the beginning of last week for unknown reasons, added to a third soldier that had committed suicide earlier in April. Zionist army officials are furious with these numbers because they consider that the publication of such data will encourage soldiers to commit suicide if they monitor the escalation of suicides in the ranks of the army. Meanwhile, Yadayot Ahranot newspaper reported that 14 Israeli soldiers committed suicide in 2022 while performing military service, with the highest toll in 5 years. Also, 11 Israeli soldiers committed suicide in 2021, while the highest rate of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army was recorded in 2011, during which 21 soldiers committed suicide. Official statistics of the research center in the Knesset showed that the Israeli entity records 500 suicides annually, of which 100 cases are recorded among the young generation from 15 to 24 years old. Suicide is considered the second cause of death among those who enlist in the Israeli occupation army, whether from the period of rehabilitation through secondary education for conscription or during compulsory military service and even in reserve service. Data shows that 80% of suicides were recorded among males and 20% among females, and that 60% of suicides were recorded in the age group from the secondary stage of conscription to the age of 26 years. However, it seems that the number of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army is higher than that, because in some cases, suicide is documented as a training accident or a road accident, which means deliberately concealing the true numbers of soldiers who committed suicide. It is inferred from the mental health unit in the Israeli occupation army that the growth of psychological disorders among the soldiers is the main reason for committing suicide, and this is due to psychological and social pressures, as well as their lack for sense of security and the state of war and continuous fighting. The Israeli study found that many suicides in the army were not only diagnosed with a psychological disorder, as most of the soldiers who committed suicide suffered from anxiety for a long time about the future and lived in a state of constant frustration, severe confusion, and a feeling of not belonging to the military framework. Estimates indicate that the manpower division in the Israeli army deliberately conceals facts about the prevalence of suicide and conceals the official and real number of soldiers who commit suicide annually. Suicide remains the main cause of death in the army if there are no Israeli military aggression campaigns.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and producer and host of the Patrick Henningsen Show, which airs on TNT Radio. Thanks a million for being with us, Patrick. With this very pressing news coming from the Palestinian occupied territories, we have a Zionist Army Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi describing the soaring increase in the suicide cases among Israeli troops as dangerous and daunting challenge for the regime's armed forces. Now, compared to other military bodies around the world, the Israeli numbers are by far the highest. What do you think might be the main cause behind the suicide at such an early age, though?
So clearly there's a problem here. It must be something going on within the IDF ranks, within the military confines, or perhaps more broadly in society there. One of the things that we have seen, though, is that drug and alcohol abuse tripled among the youth and teenagers, and some of those during the COVID lockdown period. And of course, some of those would come of age and into military service in the last 2 years. years. So that's one of the things that we can definitely see that's clear. And just in the Israel society, in total, 1 out of 7 people suffer from some kind of addiction. That's about 15% of all of society. And, you know, societies that have a major drug problem, you often see signals of a rise in suicides as well. But the military poses its own unique set of problems. But, you know, as a country, according to global statistics, it's not shown as a massive uptick in overall suicide. So this appears to be a phenomenon that is definitely local to the military, and more specifically male conscripts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it seems that the number of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army is actually higher than what the Israeli entity is declaring and revealing, because in some cases suicide is being documented as accidents or a training accident or a road accident, which means deliberately concealing the true numbers of soldiers who are committing suicide within the occupation army. Nothing really, though, hides forever, especially inside of the Zionist entity. Then why are they resorting to deceit in such a pressing matter and with such high numbers?
Well, I would be myself somewhat cautious in speculating too much without seeing the hard evidence that there's actual misreporting going on with the official numbers, i.e., are they accurate or not? However, what I can point out is that this issue can be a devastating issue for public relations, for military, especially within recruitment mainly. And consider this fact, the United States, that since 9/11, suicides in the military have outpaced actual deaths in military operations. Just think about that for a minute. So, you know, the U.S. military has worked really hard to kind of minimize this, to cover it up, that there's a massive crisis here over the last 20 years. But now the numbers are out, and it's a totally devastating trend. Normally, the military will have lower suicide rates than society in general. But in the U.S., that trend is totally reversed. Why? Psychological issues. There's a sort of pathology that might be unique to that. And they're not counting veterans as well in those official numbers. And for the IDF, that might also be the case. If they were to count veterans, I'm sure you could talk about a much bigger overall crisis than what's being reported.
Well, Patrick, statistics indicate that the population groups of RICS that are at risk of suicide are among the Jewish colonial settlers, mainly who are from Russia, or the Falasha Jews and the African Jews, as well as among the elderly with the age group of 75 years. That's astonishing. It's being said that it's due to economic and social reasons, and that they are feeling somewhat alienated from the settler Israeli society. But knowing this fact, how do you perceive the recruitment procedure by the occupation entity, which takes the recruit out of the environment that he actually knows or she knows, and it's causing them great depression and disruption in their life, leading to suicide?
Well, with the immigration issue, it's interesting. I mean, looking at the studies, they are, quote, relatively high in comparison to other groups, looking at Ethiopians, immigrants, Jewish immigrants specifically. But we must also consider this fact that, Israel's rates is not in the top tier among nations. However, within the immigrant community, there's massive problems in Israel with integration difficulties, discrimination, language. These are all contributing factors which can be looked at. But overall, I'd say when considering immigrants, definitely it's the economic pressures, and I think that's throughout society as well, economic hardship, fluctuations in social welfare payments, employment problems. These are all primary drivers of clinical depression. Hence, you have to correlate that with suicide rates. And so that can also spill into the military population as well.
Well, we still have a bit of time here, Patrick. I want to ask you about this from a different perspective. I mean, if you look at it from outside, you see that there is a community that is being oppressed by the occupation, and then you have the settler occupation. Wouldn't it be more sensible to see such numbers, for example, in the Palestinian communities who are always under oppression, who are always besieged, for example, in Gaza? And still, in Gaza, the biggest open-air prison in the world, and we don't see such rates of suicide amongst the community of the Palestinians. Do you think that in another situation, that should have been reversed, but it's not? What does that tell you about the settler colonial societies inside of occupied Palestine?
Well, I think it tells you, certainly you might be looking at a sort of a disconnect, a psychological disconnect with the sort of hypocrisy of the situation and the fact that, you know, some people are just not younger people, especially coming, new generations coming in, they're not as maybe militant ideologically as their parents and grandparents were. So they might be feeling the hypocrisy of the situation. And this also feeds into clinical depression and other problems psychologically. So I wouldn't begin to speculate, as I'm not a clinical psychologist, but certainly there's plenty of issues there that would, if one was to study closely, that would be sort of gaping realities within the society.
It's like actually exporting the U.S. society or the Western society in general into that specific area, which is foreign to the communities around it. Because in all of the Arab communities, we don't see such high numbers of suicide. Suicide by itself is a notion that's unacceptable within the Arab world, within the Islamic and the Christian Arab world. And you still see some sort of an exporting of the Western values and ideologies and mental model, if you will, into the Israeli entity. Could that also be part of the problem?
Yeah, well, the Western progressive civilization just often it does not live up to what it bills itself as. And I think we're starting to see that a backlash on that. And that can also be expressed in sort of, you know, severe psychological issues with people and turning to drugs, turning to alcohol just to cope with what is clearly a dysfunctional society. So yeah, the Western model is definitely has a lot to be desired. Across the world, in fact. So these things are being challenged now.
Well, it is truly an interesting subject to dive into. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, and also host and producer of the Patrick Henningsen Show, which airs on TNT Radio. I advise you to listen to that. That's an amazing show. I like it a lot. Thank you very much, Patrick, for being with us. And ladies and gents, promise you to give you more updated news from the region of West Asia next week, inshallah, on the Middle East stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The Limelight.
U.S. Democrats claim to support reining in out-of-control defense spending and criticize Republicans for serving America's most powerful corporate interest while doing exactly that themselves. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. The website of Yahoo News writes, top Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. are holding a fundraising meeting with major arms companies on Thursday, April 27th, as Washington plunges into a budget battle in which concessions to the Pentagon and the defense industry could mean cuts to welfare programs such as food stamps. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, his deputy Pete Aguilar, and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC Chair, Representative Susan Delbin, have been selected as the honorees to be invited to the event. The downtown D.C. function, dubbed as Defense and National Security Dinner, is set to raise funds for the committee, which is the campaign arm for House Democrats and is central to their hopes of regaining the lower chamber of Congress. Dozens of representatives of Pentagon contractors, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, SpaceX, Palantir, and General Dynamics, will attend the event. The group includes figures who previously worked for congressional Democrats, such as Shauna Candler, Director of Government Relations at General Dynamics. Candler spent 15 years as Chief of Staff for Representative Adam Smith, the Democratic Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and another co-host of the Thursday's event. The event could provide a significant signal about the priorities of the House Democrats as they prepare for 2024 elections and battle Republicans who are demanding spending cuts in exchange for passing critical legislation. It could be a disappointing message to those who want the party to support social justice and progressive reform. A senior congressional aide said news of the fundraiser set off alarm bells among staffers, and the event could be a stark example of senior U.S. Democratic leaders saying one thing but doing another. Democrats claim to support reining in out-of-control defense spending and criticize Republicans for serving America's most powerful corporate interests while doing exactly that themselves. In the coming months, Democratic lawmakers are expected to make key decisions that will affect the U.S. defense industry as they fight Republican efforts to cut government spending. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he wants comprehensive cuts, but signals from influential Republicans and analysis by budget experts suggest that McCarthy will protect the Pentagon budget. Democrats can also demand limits on Pentagon spending to protect other government agencies. However, the defense industry will lobby hard to prevent